Hello and welcome to this Landlord Law Live webinar, recorded on the 6th of March 2014. Today my guest is Ian Potter, the Managing Director of ALA. Ian is due to retire in June, so I invited him here today to share with us some of his knowledge of the property industry. Let the webinar begin. So welcome, Ian. Ian is the Managing Director of ALA, but he's done a lot of other things in his life. And Ian, you didn't start working in property, did you?
No, I didn't. I started working in banking. So a few years ago, I used to, at the point in time that the property market crashed, I said I'd been responsible for crashing two industries, banking and property. That's not quite true. I spent over 20 years in banking, in various posts, branch banking, head office department banking, worked in compliance for a period as well. I also did mortgage underwriting, and I think that was what whetted my appetite for property. Mm-hmm. And when I decided that time was right to leave banking, because I became totally disillusioned with it, I came into the residential lettings industry to do, in fact, the client accounting.
Uh-huh.
And that's always been one of my pets, if you like, pet hates maybe, but certainly something that I've spent a lot of time trying to encourage agents to get their client accounting correct.
So that's the financial records that they keep and keeping the money separate?
Absolutely, absolutely. And unfortunately, we all know that not everybody does it and not everybody even has the money.
Mm.
Over the years, we keep getting, the industry keeps getting bad publicity created by agents who have run off with clients' monies. And that's one of the things that ALA does protect their consumers from.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a client money protection and we'll pay out when it happens. And had, unfortunately, a few claims over the years.
So how did you first get involved in the property industry then? So you started working for...
I started working for an independent business in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
I actually knew the senior partner of that business before I started working with them, and he said he was looking for someone to do his accounts, and was I interested, and gave me the usual sob story that an agent will always give a new employee, we can't afford to pay you what you think you might be worth. And I accepted that challenge and said, I'll prove to you that I'm worth what I think I should be getting.
Uh-huh.
And within 18 months, I'd got a partnership, and we built up the business, and we continued to build that business up. It was sold in the mid-1990s, and I think the expression we would use today was, I was sold with it.
Right,
and
okay.
Stayed with that company until 2000. I then moved to one of the big corporates, and then I came to work full-time with ALA. But I'd been on the ALA board, the ALA Council, as it was called in those days, since 1992, so I've been involved with ALA for a long time.
So what made you want to go and work with ALA? What attracted you to ALA?
It was what it stood for, the standards that it was trying to set, and at the point in time that I came to work, we were going through quite a lot of change in the industry. The 2004 Housing Act had started to impact on the industry. We knew that tenancy deposit protection was coming, and I felt that ALA had an opportunity and ALA had a role to play in helping to raise the standards around the private rented sector. And we have grown quite a lot. ALA now has over 7,000 individual members across the whole of the UK.
Mm-hmm. So what was your particular work with ALA?
I started off when I was on the board. I was involved in various committees, but I finished up doing finance, putting my banking expertise mm-hmm. to work, and doing compliance work, looking at all the accountants' reports that weren't straightforward, that weren't clean. And mm-hmm. Then when I came to work full-time, initially it was this business and compliance manager. And then I became operations manager and then managing director.
Mm-hmm. Which is your position now. So what's the vision that ALA has? I mean, what's the sort of message and its main vision for the industry and for the future?
What we want to see, and we are seeing at the moment, is an expanding private rented sector. Back in 1988, the private rented sector was less than 8% of the housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
We've now seen just very recently the government's own figures saying the private rented sector is bigger than the social rented sector in England.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really good, but it's still an unregulated industry. There's still an awful lot of bad practice. And we are going to see some of that addressed with the requirement for all letting agents to belong to a consumer redress scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how you raise that standard, how you get the education, how you get the training, how you get the knowledge out there. And one of the things that ARLA has developed over the years is a very comprehensive range of qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
And they are regulated qualifications through Ofqual. So it means that we have standards that we've to adhere to in the delivery of those qualifications. And I'm very passionate about that. I've done some training myself. I don't do a lot. But I believe that that is how we improve the industry. It's how you can... A lot of what is perceived as bad practice is actually ignorance.
Yes.
And people say that we've got rogue landlords. And yes, we do have some that get the industry a bad name, but an awful lot of the mistakes that people come across are actually not deliberate wrongdoings. They are ignorant wrongdoings. And it is a real challenge to get people understanding that and getting the thirst for knowledge to make sure that they know what they're doing or know where to go to get advice from people like you that provide that service.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you feel about, I mean, obviously, I think everybody agrees that agents ought to be regulated because they hold a very responsible position, and also, crucially, they hold a lot of other people's money as well. What do you feel about the idea of landlord regulation? Because the provision of housing is an important social function.
I think that there is a very strong case for it within the industry. I have absolutely nothing against a landlord wanting to let the property themselves. It's a commercial decision for them how they're going to do it. But there is a real danger that if we get one bit of the industry regulated and the other not, that we don't get the benefits through that would come through if the whole industry is regulated. I think what Wales are proposing actually has a huge amount of merit, that a landlord will have a choice. They either get themselves qualified and accredited under the proposed legislation, or they use a qualified and accredited agent. So there is that choice. But what the landlord will not be able to do under the Welsh model is carry on doing it themselves if they don't know what they're doing. That way, you improve the consumer experience. You reduce the amount of complaints that people like OFT get, that Shelter get. Having seen some of the cases they get and some of the problems that they get, I can empathise with the complainant. But a lot of it could be eradicated. It'd be interesting to see how the new experience actually pans out at the end of the day, because what they're doing there is groundbreaking, really, in as much as it's the whole borough that has to be operating to the standard under their licensing scheme. One of the things with landlord accreditation schemes that we've seen in the early days was a tick box exercise by the local authority and by the landlord. All that they had to do was complete the form, join the scheme, and they were an accredited landlord. Well, that is actually pretty meaningless.
I mean, the enforceability of standards is very important. Otherwise, you know, it's meaningless in a way having them. I mean, so far as ARLA is concerned, if an ARLA-regulated agent falls short of the standards, what are the penalties imposed by ARLA? How do you enforce your own standards now?
Well, it depends what the complainant is looking for, but all our members have to belong to a consumer redress scheme, one of the ombudsman schemes. And the first route, if the complainant is looking for financial compensation, is that they go to the ombudsman scheme, because the ombudsman can award redress. It can award up to 25,000. And after that, if they still wish other action taken against that member, that can come to us as a complaint. And obviously they would have the ombudsman adjudication as further evidence to the problem that they've had with the member. Mm-hmm. And we can take disciplinary action. We do take disciplinary action, and we do remove memberships.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that that only puts the problem into a different place.
Yes, that's right.
It doesn't solve the problem.
Yes.
And that's why we need this joined up thinking, this very holistic approach to it, to make it happen properly.
One thing that worries me slightly, Ian, is that the proposals for Wales sound all nice and good, but I'm unhappy about there being a difference between Wales and England, because we've already got a difference between England and Wales and Scotland. It would be better if there were unified standards, across the United Kingdom, rather than being split up with different standards in different areas.
You're not only going to have different standards going forward, you're actually going to have different laws as well.
Well, that's what I meant, yes, different laws.
Because, I mean, Wales, as you know, has a second bill coming forward that will actually change the tenancy regime, or at least the proposal in it is that it will change the tenancy regime totally. They're looking to adopt the Law Commission's proposals, which were updated specifically for the Welsh Government. The Scottish Government are very likely to do the same thing. We hear that Northern Ireland may do the same thing. So we're going to finish up with different sets of rules around different parts of the country, which is, as you say, it doesn't help get over a consistent message. But we do have micro markets as well. The problems that exist in London and the South East are totally different to the problems that exist in the North West or the North East. The private rented sector in Scotland is only about 12% of the housing stock, not the 18% that it is in England. And Wales is a different figure again. So it's a fact of life that we've got a UK structure that is breaking down in one way or another. And I'm not being nationalistic when I say that at all. We are going to have to live with that and realise that the markets are going to be different. It does impact on investment decisions for landlords as well, not least the institutions, because they're looking at it all the time. What should we be doing? What could we be doing? Under what jurisdiction are we going to be doing it? And what is that jurisdiction going to look like in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years time?
You're based in, well, you're from Scotland yourself. I mean, what particular differences have you seen between the Scottish system and the English Welsh system?
There's not a huge difference, really. I mean, everyone said to me, you know, working down south, you'll struggle to understand the legislation and everything else. And I said, no, I won't. I said, because the ethos of the legislation is exactly the same. It's to protect both sides of a transaction. It's a legal contract. A tenancy agreement, at the end of the day, is a contract in law. It's just created under the Housing Act or the conditions around the Housing Act and various other pieces of legislation. And what is it meant to do is it's meant to clearly state what people's obligations are, both landlords and tenants. When I started out, and you'll remember these days as well, Tessa, where the tenancy agreement was 2 pages long. If it was that. Today, tenancy agreements are 20-plus pages long, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because they contain so much more information. The problem is that it is written in legal language rather than in language that the consumer very often understands. The plain English tenancy agreement is a real challenge. How you write stuff in plain English when it has huge legal implication is not something that I think anybody really knows the answer to.
Well, I mean, I've put my tenancy agreements into a plain English format, and it was a bit of a challenge to do it, but I think it's very worthwhile because people can actually understand what they say.
Well, that's right. Albeit, I don't think that, I don't mean this disrespectfully to what you've done, Tessa, at all, but, I mean, we've seen some really weird interpretations or unexpected interpretations of tenancy law in the last 10 months. Until a tenancy agreement in itself has been challenged and tested at a higher level than the basic courts, then we really don't know how it will all stand up.
The Law Commission, in their report in 2006, suggested that there should be standard clauses for tenancy agreements which would be fixed, and I have to say I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, as you're aware, DCLG Select Committee recommended a model tenancy agreement, and DCLG have said that they will look at a model tenancy agreement without making that tenancy agreement mandatory. They seem to be not sure what direction that's going to take. Last I heard, the last meeting I was at, they were speaking about core clauses.
Yes.
And that's fine. But the last time we had government guidance on tenancy agreements, we finished up with superstrike. My initial reaction to the government when I was told of what they were going to say as their response last autumn to the Select Committee report was, so how many super strikes are you going to create in your model tenancy agreement? And then we've got the other interpretation in the more recent case, Spencer versus Taylor, which some people actually argue contradicts some of the thinking of super strike. So I don't personally subscribe too widely to that theory, albeit the issue as to whether periodic tenancy is a new tenancy or not. Spencer versus Taylor says that it's the same tenancy. Superstrike says it's not. Superstrike says it is a new tenancy.
Yeah.
So there is that contradiction there. Most of the authoritative writers suggest that Spencer versus Taylor overrides Church Commissioners versus Meyer, but the judgment didn't actually say that. It didn't refer to that case. It didn't refer to that case at all. So what we've got is even more complicated situation. So model tenancy agreements are only going to be as good as the drafting of it. And one of the big problems we've got, a lot of modern housing legislation is very woolly in its wording.
It's very badly drafted. So let's move away from the strict legal side now and cover some of the other questions I've got down here. We've had a question come in from a lady who is thinking of setting up a letting agency, and she asked for your advice on what she should do. I mean, her specific questions are whether she should be as a sole trader or a limited company and about insurance. But perhaps if you could just give some general guidance to people who are thinking of setting up a letting agency.
How long have you got?
About 4 minutes.
Strangely enough, I did a presentation on this yesterday to a group of estate agents on the basis where you're thinking about adding lettings. And I couldn't get it shorter than 40 bullet points, things that they need to take into consideration. I think your questioner's topics are interesting because what she needs to do, what they both highlight, is that she needs professional backup to her business. The business structure, there's no right and there's no wrong. It's what she wants out of it, what her ambitions for her business are, what her tax position is, everything else. So she needs to be taking her business structure advice from, I would suggest, both an accountant and a lawyer, so that she understands what she's doing. As far as her insurance is concerned, she needs to be speaking to a specialist broker that will tell her all the policies that she should be having and or all the conditions that she should have in her business insurance. It's not just a case of going along and buying something off the shelf. What is she going to be doing? Is she going to be running a fleet of cars with her business? Is she going to be transporting clients in her company car? All sorts of different things will impact on the insurance that she needs. So it is a very complex situation. The other thing is, if she has no experience of the industry at all, where is she going to go to get her training? Because you cannot become an agent without knowledge. The law allows you to do it. You can go along and open your business anywhere you want, but it's a very dangerous thing to do if you don't know what you're doing. So she needs to get that training, that knowledge. I would suggest your best route is to get a formal qualification in the industry, but you would expect me to say that, and then build on that. If she has never worked in an agency before, find somebody that will give her an opportunity to actually see what happens in the business on a day-to-day basis, because it can be very, very intense. If you've got medium-sized, large-sized portfolio, both your landlords and your tenants are very, very demanding. So how are you going to deal with your customer service? How are you going to deal with repairs at 24/7, 365 that are expected out there in the marketplace today? All sorts of different considerations. So yes, it's not just a two-minute answer, Tessa.
Right. Well, I think we need to wrap up, Ian. Could we perhaps you could just end by just giving your predictions for the future and any sort of short bullet point advice that you've got for our audience today?
That's a challenge and a half, Tessa.
I know. I did give you the questions in advance.
I think we will see the private rented sector continuing to grow. I really do believe we will start to see some kind of regulation of it. It may be different all over the countries we were saying. I do hope that it has the desired effect, which is to improve the professionalism of the sector. And I use that with a small p, not a large p. Mm-hmm. And that the consumer gets a consistent experience in the sector rather than being subject to very good, very bad, and somewhere in the middle. So that it becomes a tenure of choice rather than where it still, for a lot of people, is a tenure of last resort. And I think if we can achieve that for the private rented sector, it will grow. It has been an awful lot bigger. It was over 90% of housing stock in 1910.
Well, 100 years ago.
Yeah. That's right. It was over 90% of the population lived in the private rented sector. So there's been a huge change. And lots of that change has been caused by governments meddling in legislation, rent controls being one of them, and that meant that the investor landlord could not maintain their property. We need to be careful just how much we meddle with legislation. It needs to be balanced. It needs to be prescriptive. And I think we could have a very, very strong private rented sector that may very well have changed its dynamic if we see institutional investment.
So, that is the end of the Ian Potter interview on Landlord Law Live. Many thanks to Ian for agreeing to be my guest and for being such an interesting interviewee. To find out more about Arla, visit their website at www.arla.co.uk. You can find out more about Landlord Law Live and sign up to all our forthcoming live events at our website, www.landlordlawlive.co.uk. Thank you for listening.